From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The scale and audacity of the Enron scandal still defy belief. Now come the incredible details from New York Times investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald. For 3 years, Eichenwald dug into the giant closets of one of the biggest business scandals in the country's history. Now the best-selling author of The Informant takes us behind the corporate walls of Enron into the center of what became a perfect storm of power, corruption, greed, and he says, no little stupidity. Tonight on Point, a conspiracy of fools and the inside story of the end of Enron with the New York Times' Kurt Eichenwald. But first tonight, we begin at the United Nations in New York, where UN Secretary General Kofi Annan today proposed some of the most radical reforms in that institution's history. He offered up an agenda for overhaul to be considered at a summit of world leaders in September. Maggie Farley covers the United Nations for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her to describe the forces that brought Annan before the UN today with his push for change.
We have to step back a little bit. 5 years ago, at the Millennium Summit for the United Nations, all of the nations here agreed on some very ambitious development goals, and they asked the Secretary General to report back on that in 5 years, which is now. But he decided that he had to do more than that. In addition to trying to cut the world's poverty in half, he wanted to reinvent the entire United Nations because it was broke and it needed to be fixed or it was going to die. Last year, after the UN was skirted in the run-up to the Iraq War, he decided to appoint a panel of high-level experts to come up with some proposals on how to reform the UN. They came up with a report at the end of last year, and this big vision that he presented today draws heavily on that report. So it's really been kind of 5 years in the making and at least a year for these specific recommendations.
We'll talk about the steps that he outlined today, but what are his goals here? Kofi Annan's goals? His goal is to make the UN more what? Fill in the blank.
More relevant, more efficient, more transparent, and a place where the United States wants to come solve its problems.
And how would he do that? What are the major changes he's proposing?
He wants to expand the Security Council to make it look more like the world is today and not like the world 60 years ago when the UN was born. He wants to eliminate the much discredited and maligned Human Rights Commission, which has turned in to really a refuge for human rights violators instead of a body that monitors or castigates them.
Mm.
He wants to make this place really the theater for peace and security decisions like what happened before Iraq and what didn't happen before Iraq, and to set out some rules that everybody can agree on so Iraq doesn't happen again.
On that in particular, there's a resolution here that would establish a new set of principles regarding the use of force. How would it make the UN sign-off different there? How might it have changed the conversation, the green light or red light on Iraq?
The resolutions that were being negotiated before Iraq were very vague and intentionally so people could appear to agree while pursuing their own agendas.
The resolution, for one, that the United States put forward then.
Right, the United States put forward, and then there was disagreement about whether or not the United States needed to come back and seek the Security Council's blessing before going into Iraq. What the Secretary General is trying to do is to get everybody to agree, and he says he doesn't have a real opinion one way or the other what the rules should be, except for the UN should be central to it. But he wants everybody to agree, so there's not that kind of bruising battle and embarrassing fight that caused further divisions rather than bringing about solutions.
So it's a very ambitious kind of buffet of changes, but he's told the General Assembly today, don't look at this as an a la carte menu. Take this whole reform plan, implement it all. Is there a chance of that happening? Is there any chance of that happening?
Well, the reason he says that is because he very carefully crafted it to give somebody everything. He kind of pre-negotiated it, if you will. In fact, one ambassador says he tried to give us something appetizing, but he also is trying to chew it for us.
Mm.
And there is a lot of it that's hard to swallow. So I'm not sure that everything is going to go through. In fact, I think it's probably impossible that everything he wants to see go through will go through, and especially by September, as he has asked.
How is Washington likely to respond to these proposals?
Some things they should be very happy about, like eliminating the Human Rights Commission. Not something that they really wanted. They've been pounding on that for a long time. Other things like rules for use of force, they won't like at all because they don't want to have any constraint on their own national defense and defending their interests. Other things are kind of innovative, and they've been floating around here in the last couple of months, which is controlling nuclear materials, not letting countries like Iran and North Korea create their own fuel cycle for nuclear energy, but instead having the International Energy Association control the fissile material and supply it to countries like North Korea and Iran, and then take away their waste material. So there's no chance of them using it as weapons. And that's kind of interesting because it eliminates the need for showdown diplomacy.
Maggie, all this is being proposed not long before results of a probe are due out on the actions of Kofi Annan and his son in the UN Oil for Food program with Iraq. What's the conversation around the UN today? Is there a chance of this getting through? Is this pie in the sky? What's the moment for the UN here and the chance of real reform?
I think this is the best chance that they're going to have. And the oil for food scandal has been very distracting and very undermining of people's confidence all around the world and in the United Nations. And any hint that the Secretary General's son might have used his father's position to win contracts for his company would be extremely damaging, even if Kofi Annan had nothing to do with it. Right now, he needs all of the help he can get, and so he's trying to act like a leader, implement this whole package of reforms, and have the legacy of the one who made the United Nations work.
Maggie Farley in New York, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Maggie Farley is United Nations reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She joined me there from New York. For 6 years in the 1990s boom, Fortune magazine crowned Enron America's most innovative company. Then in the fall of 2001, it all came tumbling down. The end was a strange combination of scandal, tragedy, and farce. Tonight, Kurt Eichenwald, investigative reporter for the New York Times, takes us deep into the end of Enron and the stories of the Enron managers that America has come to know on a first-name basis. Ken Lay, Jeff Skilling, Andy Fastow, and the layers of conspiracy, deceit, and folly that surrounded them. Tonight on Point, the inside story of the end of Enron. You can join the conversation. Do you see a dark genius behind the Enron scandal or a conspiracy of fools? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Orlando, Florida, is Kurt Eichenwald, investigative reporter with the New York Times. His 2000 bestseller about corruption at Archer Daniels Midland was The Informant. His new book about the fall of Enron is Conspiracy of Fools, a true story. Kurt Eichenwald, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Kurt.
Kurt Eichenwald,
hey, how are you doing, Jack?
Good.
Kurt, this is an incredible collection of detail about the rise and fall, and mainly the fall. There's so much we want to learn from you, but I hope you'll just be generous in scooping the deep dish for us here. Let me ask you, to start with, just take us in. What's the detail, what's the anecdote or pair of anecdotes that you tell people to begin to get them up close to what happened at Enron, the kind of most representative anecdote? Begin to take us in here.
You mean how I start the book, or just
well,
the ones I like the best?
Any way you like. What do you find turns people's heads to say, "Oh my God, I had no idea it was like that"?
Well, I mean, interestingly, you know, it's very hard for me to pick a single item. The reason why what I do with my books is try and take a story, an event, in this case the Enron scandal, and re-report it to the extent that I can write it in the form of a novel. You know, it's not untrue. It's not a novel, it's untrue. But it's everything in it, every fact in it comes from someplace. And so you end up, rather than with me telling you, here's what you should think about these events, you get to see the events up close and personal. And like you said in the intro, the whole idea is to sort of write true Grisham thrillers. If I had to pick two things, probably the two that are most representative of any, of something. One is at the beginning of the book, you get to witness what I would call the breakdown, one of the emotional breakdowns of Jeff Skilling, the chief executive of the company, or the former chief executive at that point. And it's a fairly intimate moment. I mean, it's you watch him drinking himself into a stupor, and then going back to his hotel room with his fiance.
This is when he's in Miami with his fiance, and he's
right.
into his 15th and 16th and beyond glass of wine. He's going down on purpose.
He's going down. I mean, he basically has decided that Enron is going. There's nothing can save it, and he's going to drink himself certainly to the edge.
To oblivion.
Yes. And at some point, he just realizes that, you know, his world is imploding, and he wants his fiance to get away, and he starts screaming at her to leave, to go back to Houston. And she finally does, and he just crumples into the bed and begins to cry into the pillow.
This is the great and mighty Jeff Skilling.
Yes, there's that scene. There is also one of the more both tragic and amusing scenes is, in my mind, is late in the book when Ken Lay is being told about a partnership by the name of Chuco that had as its primary investor the domestic partner of an Enron finance executive named Michael Copper. The problem with that is, number one, nobody knew about it.
And when you say domestic partner, you mean gay domestic partner, and
his gay domestic partner, yes, his gay lover.
And Ken Lay is confronted with this, and he's just astounded.
What's so interesting? I mean, this is everything. All the boats are going off. I mean, every hinge is coming unhinged, and they're trying to now figure out about this entity. And he is told, you know, it's Michael Copper's partner. And he's like, what, his business partner? What are you talking about? Finally, they say, it's his gay lover. And he throws his arms up and says, what is going on around here?
You've got him screaming. And there, the end of Enron is coming close. Kurt Eichenwald, author of the new book, Conspiracy of Fools. Stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the unbelievable saga of the end of Enron. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the unbelievable saga of the end of Enron. Our guest is Kurt Eichenwald. He's investigative reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, Conspiracy of Fools, A True Story. It's big and it is packed with detail like you've probably never heard it about the fall of this colossal corporation. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Enron's tale a story of criminality or incompetence or both? Given the damage done, what would now constitute justice for Ken Lay, Jeff Skilling, and the rest? What are the lessons to be learned from Enron's rise and fall? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kurt, I hope you'll walk us through the kind of levels of culpability and foolishness, to bring up your word here. But first, just remind us in a nutshell of the Enron story. This was a pipeline company that in the 90s became something else and then blew up. What happened? Why?
Okay. Enron was a pipeline company that ultimately became, for lack of a better term, a risk manager, an energy risk manager. It would sell contracts, trade-in contracts that would allow for customers to guarantee their prices going forward of gas, that would give them a guaranteed supply at a guaranteed price. Ultimately, they did the same thing with electricity. From there, they built out into a number of other businesses. They had an international business that was going beforehand. That grew rapidly. They had they built a water business. They built a weather derivatives business. They built an industrial markets business, a broadband business, basically a lot of businesses that had nothing to do with what they knew.
And why were they described again and again by Fortune magazine as the most innovative company in America? What was the kind of new age, new wave patina that they took on?
Well, I mean, ultimately, they were the most innovative company in America because they weren't doing things the way a normal business does. I mean, they were going out into new cutting-edge businesses, having absolutely no idea what they should be doing, what they should be spending their money on.
These were cutting-edge because they were using the new sort of wired era to do what?
Well, they had some great innovations. They had Enron Online, which was basically using the internet to help create a gas marketplace, and that did work. They had or an electricity marketplace. They had an entity that was again designed to do the retail business over the internet. That was part of its business. They had broadband trading, which was basically people would be able to trade out their broadband access when they didn't need it and trade in to where they did need it. So they did have a lot of very, very innovative ideas, a lot of very innovative strategies.
But backed up by a kind of whole set of corrupt arrangements, as you describe it, that finally brought them down.
There was the corruption, and there was also just, you know, I don't want to understate how ridiculous some of the business ideas they had were in terms of how they executed them. You know, they went – broadband is a simple example. I mentioned broadband trading. Well, that was just one of the multiple conflicting businesses they were in broadband. They were doing broadband trading. They were doing – building what they called the intelligent network. They were doing video on demand. And they did each one of these, which would have taken up the effort of any major corporation – and threw everything they had into each one while at the same time running this energy company. And ultimately, they all failed. And, you know, the one thing that is the amazing track record of Enron is once you get to about 1994, virtually every business they start fails. The problem comes in with, you know, if the market knows they're into these businesses that fail, the market's going to exact its revenge. And that's where the crimes come in. They begin to figure out a lot of ways, number one, to make the losses not appear, and also how to make the debts associated with those businesses not appear.
We want to look at everybody's culpability and the way you find them in the midst of that vice after a while there. But Jack Beatty, come in with us here first. I mean, the grandeur of the ambition or hubris, whatever you want to call it here, and the ultimate scandal, really staggering.
It is, and I've seen Kurt talk about this, and the stories are just hair-raising, and I'll get right out of the way of them. But first, let's consider the political context here for a minute. You know, the conventional wisdom was that the Enron scandal was really going to hurt Bush because, after all, Bush, Ken Lay was, quote, Kenny Boy to George Bush. And, of course, Mr. Bush said, oh, heck, I barely knew the guy. You know, and, of course, he had been in the Oval Office. He had met with Dick Cheney. He'd been one of his main financial supporters. But as soon as the scandal blew up, oh, Ken who?
Kenny who?
Yeah. And, okay, let's take the clock back to Bush's first election. He's just won by the skin of his teeth, by the grace of Clarence Thomas. And he's looking out, or I should say Karl Rove is looking out at the political contenders for the year 2004. Mm-hmm. And he's got a sort of grid that says, here's what we don't want. We don't want a social conservative governor, Catholic, war veteran from the South or West. That's what we don't want. And he looks out on the board and he says, well, let's see, there is one of these. Oh, Gray Davis, the governor of California. Isn't that something? Okay. Then in June, Mr. Cheney has his meeting with the energy companies.
The famous meeting that shall never be spoken of.
We don't know anything about that. We can't.
Well, actually, let me interject.
Yes,
Kurt. The meeting's in the book. I show you everything that happened.
I'll show you everything
they talked about.
Jack, I see where you're headed there, but Kurt, tell us about that meeting then. Is there some dark secret there that should turn the Bush administration upside down?
No. I mean, unfortunately, it's, you know, once I there were a lot of people in that meeting that people are not aware of. There was also a written record and there was also a documentary record. These are the things that all of this litigation is about, where people are trying to gain access to this material. It's the one thing about lawsuits is you have to go by, you know, great long processes. The great thing about journalism is I just get to knock on people's doors at night and say, gimme, gimme. And I got all that material. I spoke to people who were there. The reality is that I would love to say they carved up the world and Ken Lay got half and Dick Cheney got the other half. But because that would be a great headline.
And what about the direction that Jack is going here? Gray Davis looked like someone that Karl Rove didn't want in the way.
Well, let me go on with
yes,
that
please.
Direction. Because what, you know, this is, all right, they have a meeting. I mean, they could have all kinds of meetings. But and Enron implodes in August of 2001. What happens in July? California's energy crisis. Now, we know from subsequent testimony, I've even heard some of it on recorded bugged recordings on NPR, that Enron was up to its scuppers in manipulating that, and basically that did bring down Gray Davis. And, you know, so you could say Enron contributed as an objective fact. Enron contributed to the downfall of the leading contender. If you go back to 2001.
Gray Davis, no ball of charisma, Gray Davis, Jeff.
Yeah, Gray Davis is a big character in my book, too.
Kurt Eichenwald, you've been up to your hips in this. What do you make of this line of thinking?
Well, there are a few problems with it. Number one, the California energy crisis started actually in May of 2000. One of the things you do – now, Enron did not cause the California energy crisis. There are a lot of reasons for what happened, which actually you get to see them play out. Ultimately, Enron is like a buzzard. Enron and a lot of the other energy traders are going in and picking as much flesh as they can off of this carcass. They certainly made things dramatically worse. But that there would not have been an energy crisis if there had been no Enron, that's actually not the case. When you hear these tapes, and the tapes are horrifying, when you hear these tapes, what you are hearing is them ripping off a dying man. They have gone in and they are taking everything they can. They're taking advantage of the situation every way they can. They're making it worse in every way they can. Ripping this world apart. I mean, the interesting thing, let's not even get to the Bush administration. Mm. You get to see Gray Davis interacting with the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. You get to see that there was this secret meeting, as long as we talk about secret meetings, between members of the Treasury Department, members of the White House, and members of the Energy Department in the Clinton administration that took place in its final days, where they are trying to negotiate a way out of the California energy crisis with Gray Davis. And these negotiations, I mean, they unfold over many, many months that these things are happening. And this ends with a lot of frustration about Gray Davis. And a bunch of the Treasury officials get together afterwards. And one of them says, and this line's in the book, come the 2004 convention, who's going to lead the anybody but Gray Davis effort? Mm-hmm. Gray Davis is made a lot of his own bed here. The problems that existed were existing long before Bush came into office. Kurt, were really taking place.
Turn the wheel back into Enron for us here, and help us understand first these three guys who we've heard so much about, and we'll hear more about when the trials of Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling convene next January. But what about Lay, Skilling, and Fastow? How do you describe their interaction, the roles each of them play, the sort of moments that illustrate what they were all about?
Lay is the pipeline executive. I mean, when you get right down to it, Lay is an individual who you have to think of him sort of being, you know, he was the head of a bank in the 1960s, and suddenly he wakes up and he's running the American Express Company. Mm. This is someone who, you know, doesn't know a lot about derivatives, doesn't know a lot about the kind of business lines they're in. And much to his blame, doesn't get out of the way. He allows this company to go into businesses that he's not particularly adept at. But more importantly, he allows them to go into businesses that he does know well that don't make any sense, dropping billions of dollars on overseas international power plants that, you know, where you're going to be delivering the most expensive power to the world to one of the world's poorest nations. I think any 4-year-old could figure out that doesn't make a lot of sense. It didn't make a lot of sense. It didn't work. Going into businesses they didn't know, like the water business, that was his responsibility.
When it all starts falling apart, you describe him as he reads as though he's blindsided from every direction. Does that mean the Bernie Ebers defense might work for him when he goes to court?
Well, bear in mind, he is not charged. And this is something that, you know, nobody seems to understand. Ken Lay has not been charged with the accounting fraud at Enron. He has not been charged with involvement in the Fastow machinations. I read a review the other day that said, well, Eichenwald doesn't link Ken Lay to the Fastow corruption. It's like, well, neither does the Enron task force.
But there are seven counts of fraud and conspiracy.
Those all come in the last 12 weeks. And what he is charged with is making statements about Enron's financial condition that he knew to be false. those charges, in fact, the circumstances behind every one of those charges are laid out in the book in vivid detail. A number of people have read it and walked away saying they think Kenley is guilty. A number of people have read it and walked away saying they think Kenley is not guilty. I don't give anybody the benefit of saying, here's what you should think, here's what I think. Because ultimately, you read the facts, you have all the facts I have. You know, I gained access to a lot of the government's material, you know, witness statements and the rest, grand jury testimony. And this is the case. This is what they have. And so ultimately, if, you know, you're able to look at this information and be the jury of one and make a decision about, you know, what did Kenley know and when did he know it? He certainly, in the last 12 weeks, was very, very focused on the public perception of what was going on inside of Enron.
Skilling facing a lot more charges, 30 counts, fraud, conspiracy, insider trading, right on down.
Skilling is the one with the really, really bad case against him. And by bad, I mean bad charges. These are very serious. He's linked into the Fastow fraud. He is linked into all of the – everything that happened prior to August 15th of 2001 when Kenley came back and Jeff Skilling left. And those are the meaty, bad charges involving manipulation of income, involving manipulation of the balance sheet, involving basically what everyone has come to define as the Enron scandal.
And so what's the profile of Skilling that emerges here? We've heard this hyper-aggressive, hyper-egoistic manager. What do you find?
He is a person who ultimately – I mean he's a – I would start off, he's a brilliant strategist. But I don't think he was fit to be a chief executive. He is emotionally very volatile. He is somebody who seems to be incapable of considering that he might be wrong about something. And, you know, it's one of the things about white-collar crime that, you know, if Skilling did commit a crime here, and most people do not commit crimes – you know, given the millions they have, do not commit these kinds of crimes out of greed. Everyone says it's just greed. Usually it is out of issues like envy and arrogance and pride and other elements that go to, you know, much darker darker levels of the human psyche. And I think with Skilling, you are going to see a very aggressive case and a case that is much, much harder to deal with. You're going to have direct testimony from his old friend, Andy Fastow.
That is the case the government puts up, aggressive and difficult for him
right.
to defend against.
Right. And, I mean, it's just you are in the heart of Enron darkness in that case. Mm-hmm. Now, you also don't want to sidestep Rick Causey, who is the chief accounting officer,
right.
who was on trial with both of those gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rick Causey has... He was dealing directly with Andy Fastow in these transactions, and there is, you know, a documentary trail on things he did.
And Andy Fastow, we've heard, and you paint again him as really the bad guy here.
Well, he's certainly, you know, the thing about Andy Fastow is he's the guy who ended up with the $60 million in his personal bank account.
For a while.
Until he had to give it all back. I mean, there is a drain of corporate cash going out of Enron and into bank accounts. And the bank accounts are Andy Fastow's and Michael Copper's. So they are at, you know, what people don't seem to understand is there are two different sets of crimes at Enron. There is the, what I would call the personal enrichment crimes, the embezzlement, the stealing money out of the corporation for your own personal benefit. That the only person who've been charged with that directly are Andy Fastow, Michael Copper, and the treasurer Ben Glisson, who ended up with just $1 million, but that's what he ended up
put in $5,000 and got a $1 million return,
$1 million back, right?
Not bad.
Now on the other side of it are the much bigger kinds of cases involving income manipulation, balance sheet manipulation, you know, basically fraud. And those are the cases. Fastow has pled guilty to those as well, as has Michael Copper and Ben Glisson. But that is where the testimony is going against the other executives, Rick Causey. Rick Causey's never been accused of stealing money, but he's been accused of working with Fastow to manipulate Enron's financial reports. Jeff Skilling, same thing. And then you have Ken Lay's case, which is about what he said in the final 12 weeks. Plus, there is one charge related to, the, again, those final 12 weeks of whether he lied to Anderson, Arthur Anderson, their accounting firm, for the purpose of getting a beneficial result, a beneficial statement from – where basically they didn't have to reveal something that was coming.
All of that will be on display next January when this goes to trial. In the meantime, Kurt Eichenwald's book is laying it out detail by detail by detail. You can join us tonight. Do you remember the giddy spirit of the 90s that made Enron's claims plausible? And was Enron a triumph of image and propaganda ultimately? Why was the business press so fully on board with Enron for so long? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On
Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the unbelievable saga of the end of Enron. Our guest is Kurt Eichenwald. He is New York Times investigative reporter and author of the new book, Conspiracy of Fools, A True Story. You can join us as well. Must every boom have its Enron? And was Kurt says yes. What do you think, listeners? And was Enron's management also drinking the Kool-Aid of those fevered 90s dreams? So many people were drinking it. Or were they coldly exploiting those dreams? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
First of all, I've read the first of the articles that was published in the Times, and I thought it was excellent. The second one is sitting on my night table. But I work for a competitive intelligence firm that was asked to do a competitive analysis of Enron as it first got started in the mid 90s.
Okay.
And I think what I'd like to do is say that is explain that the company's sort of soul was to a certain extent shaped by the accounting rules that they were operating under, and in fact they did conform to those rules at least at the beginning. When Enron bought gas from a supplier of gas, a company that got it out of the ground, like let's say Mobil
Right,
gas.
To load into their pipeline.
Let's go past the pipeline. When when they were no longer a pipeline company but began to sell...
buy and sell trading,
for example,
yep.
For like a 5 or 10 year delivery period to say Boston Gas.
Mm-hmm.
They then covered themselves. They went and bought gas on a long-term contract from a gas company, such as Mobil Gas.
Mm-hmm.
They had a long-term contract to supply, but the accounting rules, generally accepted accounting principles, allowed them to book all of the revenue from that contract in the year in which the contract was written, as long as they had supply locked up.
So early on, you saw them being awfully aggressive with the way they handled their accounting. What did you say to the competitors? Did you say that this company's headed for a fall?
Well, that we had a Mobil Gas executive say to us, this is a Ponzi scheme, and he explained to us that Mobil couldn't do that, but because Enron was a middleman, they could. So to say that they were being aggressive isn't quite correct. They were taking advantage of the rules, and what happened was that when you have that kind of a situation, you create this enormous sell-go-go culture. They had quarterly plans instead of annual plans because they had quarterly incentive programs for their salespeople.
So they could gobble up everything in sight. Kurt, I can also speak to this. Whose rules are we talking about here?
First of all, let me compliment the listener. He's a very smart gentleman.
Right on the money.
There's one little extra piece, which is the rules were actually Enron's. They were advanced by Enron to the SEC. Well, I'm going to adjust that in a second. They were advanced by Enron to the SEC, and because it was not allowed at first, and they lobbied for it very heavily in the early 1990s, and ultimately the Securities and Exchange Commission approved Enron using what is called mark-to-market accounting for these transactions. Now, mark-to-market accounting usually means what you're doing is looking at something you own, like a stock, and it goes from $1 to $2. You've made a dollar profit if you sell it today, and that's how mark-to-market accounting works. Enron was approved for mark-to-market, but what they were doing was very different. One government official called it mark-to-guess, where what they were doing is exactly the way your listener described it, where they would take these contracts, they would offset them, and they would recognize the revenue up front.
Right away.
Now, it's not it's not illegal, it's not improper, it's stupid, and it's irrational accounting outcome.
Stupid because?
Because ultimately what you've done is – it's stupid if you do that and you believe you actually have that revenue and can act off of it. Because ultimately what you have done is if you do 50 contracts this year and then you start next year, you have actual expenses in terms of supplying that gas,
right,
you know, every year for the next 10 years. But you now have no more revenue you can recognize. It's all
mm-hmm.
gone from last year.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to do better – this year, you need to do all 50 contracts.
So the go-go culture is partly desperation. You're on the squirrel cage.
They called it the treadmill inside.
Right.
And how do you beat the treadmill? How do you go faster than the treadmill? And as you know, as their gas trading operation got bigger and bigger and bigger, the treadmill got faster and faster. That's why they go into all these other businesses
to try and make it
something.
Up.
Yeah, because ultimately the businesses they are in is a commodities business.
Right.
And commodities, you know, don't tend to get more and more profitable over the years. They tend to get less.
And when you've booked it all up front already, you can't account for the expenses and you've got to have something to throw
you,
up
you
there.
You need something. Now, again, that is not illegal. What they did do ultimately is begin to apply the same kind of accounting of recognizing things up front in a very reckless way. And in a way that I would say was illegal, and in a way that in certain transactions, for sure, in a way that no rational person, if they heard what Enron was doing in terms of front-end recognition of earnings, would say, oh, I'm really pleased with that. I want to go buy their shares.
But there it was.
I think one of my favorite would be their video on demand business where they entered into a contract with Blockbuster, and they said, "Oh well, this contract is worth X," and so they recognized all the revenue up front.
Pronto.
Blockbuster drops out, and they say, "Well, you know, we're even better than Blockbuster. We can do the job better than Blockbuster, so it's still worth X. Maybe it's even worth more."
That's
you know,
what we
that
call
kind of stuff.
Creative.
It's not doing business. It's saying we're smarter than everybody else. We're better than everybody else.
So
and
book
we can
it right now
make up our own
and
numbers.
Call it revenue. Mike in Brookline, thanks very much for your call. Let's turn to Mike in Manhattan. Hello, Mike. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
This has been a very interesting elucidation of what's been happening at Enron, and it's the best one I've heard over years, Kurt. My question is simply this. As a follow-on to the previous Mike, who basically described how our reliance on a rules-based system of accounting, particularly for leases and project finance schemes, was exploited and probably pushed and was ultimately pushed too far
mm-hmm.
by Enron. My question is for Kurt is I would be fascinated to hear you describe something I have never heard described by any other author or magazine
Uh-oh.
Article, which is the role of Wendy Graham,
wife of
as a director
powerful
of
Texas
wife,
Senator yes. Phil Graham at that time.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, who has now gone on to be the head of UBS here. Fascinating bit of coverage, which I think would be the envy of many people in the Kremlin these days.
Well, let's go straight to it. How about the board and Wendy Graham on the board, Kurt Eichenwald?
Wendy Graham is in the book. You see a few scenes with her engaged in some of the more dramatically important issues of this company. What Wendy Graham comes off the way most of the board members come off, which is irresponsible. There's a scene where they are making a decision about one of the most important. Corporate moves they ever make, where they are giving benefits to the chief financial officer that you know create this massive conflict going forward and ultimately lead to a number of the crimes that are done. But it's being portrayed as something very different. And Wendy Graham is, you know, you see her, she's driving down the road. I think it's in Virginia. She pulls off the road. She goes up to the payphone. The wind is blowing. She's dropping her papers. She's trying very hard. She's calling in. She doesn't really hear everything all that clearly. And this is how the decisions are being made. The board, for the most part, were standing back saying, go, 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 great, great, great. You know, we love everything.
But ignorance, strictly ignorant or complicit?
I mean, no one on the board has ever been charged with anything. You know, and so, no, complicit, no. Reckless and irresponsible, yes. And, you know, this board, there was a point, actually. There was a period of time in 1998 where the board knew that Enron was going off the charts in terms of business. Again, this is not talking about crime. Mm. They spent a couple of billion dollars on a water business and a few weeks later spent a couple billion dollars on buying a Brazilian electricity distribution center, which is electricity distribution was something they didn't know anything about. Mm. And the board members are pounding the table going, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? How are we doing this? And Ken Lay says, tut, tut, don't worry, and everyone signs on. And Enron loses its shirt on both of those investments. Regarding the – there was one thing he started out – he was talking about the rules and how they're written. And there's one line in the book I actually wanted to read because it does – to me, it's sort of the heart of the whole thing.
Let's hear it.
Which is – it's ultimately it was Enron's tragedy to be filled with people smart enough to know how to maneuver around the rules but not wise enough to understand why the rules had been written in the first place. Mm. And that's sort of, in my mind, if you cut through the crime and you cut through the recklessness and you cut through the arrogance and the envy and the irresponsibility, that's the end of the line. That's the point, that they believe they were smarter than the rules and never stop and say, why is it why we aren't supposed to do that?
We've just got a couple minutes left. You said earlier that this will happen again, somehow, sometime, someplace. Why?
You know, I'm on my book tour and I've been reading – I know you're not supposed to promote other people's books when you're on a book tour. But I've been reading this fabulous book, Ponzi Scheme, which is, of course, about the original Ponzi Scheme.
This is Mitch Zuckoff's book.
Yes, fabulous
book. Right, great.
And it's – I'm reading it and just going, well, there it is. We're back in 1920 and, you know, here is – everybody believes. Everybody wants to believe. People are told there's a problem. They don't want to hear there's a problem. They don't want to they cheer the man because he's going to make everybody a millionaire overnight. And I was looking at this going, hey, it's the 1990s. We all want to be millionaires overnight. We all believe that, you know, the business rules don't apply, that it's a new paradigm and, you know, everybody's going to be rich by tomorrow. And in those environments, and only in those environments, do these kinds of reckless and irresponsible corporations or schemes emerge.
Jack Beatty, I want to put it to you, smart enough to get around the rules, not wise enough to recognize why they matter. Are we out of that era for now, Jack? What do you think?
No, that's a permanent era, because whether markets are self-regulating or not, well, we can debate that. But human beings are not self-regulating. And that's why you need the cop on the beat. You need the sanction. You need the regulation.
And, Kurt, we just got 20 seconds left. Your parting lesson from Enron here.
Capitalism is tough. If you can win either by selling the best product at the best price or by cheating. Cheating's a lot easier.
Cheating's easier. It happened, and we'll be watching the trial when it comes around next January. Kurt, thanks very much for the new book. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
New York Times investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald. His book is Conspiracy of Fools, a true story all about the end of Enron. In a moment, remembering musician Bobby Short with CBS's 60 Minutes. Ed Bradley. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is On Point. Legendary cabaret singer Bobby Short died today in a hospital in New York City. He was 80. Short was a fixture at his piano in New York's Carlyle Hotel for more than 35 years. His heartfelt renditions of American standards and his sophisticated stage presence drew some of the country's biggest names to his piano bar. He played at the White House for four presidents and became as much of a New York institution as Central Park, some said. Tonight, we remember the life and career of Bobby Short with 60 Minutes newsman Ed Bradley, a longtime follower of Bobby Short and the New York jazz scene.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring-a-sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you see,
I think that Bobby Short kept the standards alive in a way that singers today don't. I mean, some of the great songs of the 20th century, Bobby Short kept ebullient, you know, and full of life. He had the ability to to make people, no matter where they were from, if they went to see him at the Carlisle, they felt like a sophisticated New Yorker.
Sand in my shoes, sand from Havana, calling me to that ever so heavenly shore, calling me back to you once more.
Bobby Short was a master at the piano. He had a wonderful band with him, guys who had played with him for a long time. And it was a really tight group. And he was clearly the star. But I think the most important thing about Bobby Short was that he clearly enjoyed what he was doing. And that came across to his audience. He loved his material. He loved those songs. And he gave that to you when you sat out there in the audience and watched him play and watched him get up from the piano and bounce at the piano. He was just a master showman and just a superb interpreter of the best songs, the best standards that we have.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day.
Bobby Short had that ability to bring everybody together. I mean, you could go to the Carlisle and see people who were on the A-list of New Yorkers, people who were movers and shakers in arts, and on Wall Street, in communications. But you'd also find tourists from Kansas, people from Oklahoma, people from all across the country who wanted to come see Bobby Short at the Carlisle, because to them, New Yorkers and people from out of town, Bobby Short was the epitome of New York sophistication.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum.
He wasn't casual in his approach. Not that you can't be a casual sophisticate, but Bobby was always dressed to the nines. He always articulated well, and he had an air, a joie de vivre about him that just came across with his style and through his singing.
But you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till I draw.
60 Minutes newsman Ed Bradley remembering musician Bobby Short. Short died today in New York. He was 80. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come. Come the day you're mine. Come the day you're mine.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On